Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin McManus. It's December 28, 2022. Welcome to the Real Life Work Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that seems to be very popular whenever I'm working with groups, and it's the topic of why our process improvement fixes fail. And I've been talking about this topic for many years now, and it's interesting because when I first got into the process improvement world, you know, we knew we had a good fix in place if our problem went away. And that sounds so simple, but I'm going to dig into that thought a little bit as we dig more into this podcast, because often we were looking at a singular problem and we weren't fixing the larger system. So yes, the singular errors went away, but the larger issues were still occurring. But this had to do something more with what I was seeing in class. And, you know, I've taught almost 450 taproot root cause analysis classes now over 18 years. And for several of those years, we were super busy. And as you teach class after class after class, you start to see this pattern. There's a psychological pattern that causes many fixes to fail. And what surprised me is, you know, these are smart people, but they're writing these very weak fixes. And so I've seen tens of thousands of corrective and preventive actions. I've actually sat down and added them up. And if you know me, you probably know that's true. And after a while, a pattern begins to emerge. And I see the same thing when we're trying to address audit findings that are related to unsafe acts and unsafe conditions, especially unsafe acts. And this isn't just the weak fix pattern that people see in the organization. You know, I understand that habit. Yeah, you're nagging me to get it done. Okay, I'll write something. But you know what I mean by weak fixes. You know, we send people back to training. We make the procedure, you know, 5 pages longer. We punish people and hope that sends the message that everybody else better change. But you know, it's not that kind of pattern. Here's what I saw. Our fixes tend to be weak and in turn fail when we blame people and equipment for our problems. And so, in other words, if the root causes in our minds are people and equipment, and that's what we try to fix, we're going to get weak fixes. And the root causes themselves set the stage for weak versus strong corrective actions. And they're a result of the root cause questions we ask, how we collect and analyze evidence, and the design of the root cause analysis process itself. So keep in mind what Henry Ford said, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. So what we're going to do in this podcast is, first of all, we're going to look at some reasons why corrective actions fail. And as I'm going through those, you can see which ones ping with you. Once we've got done beating ourselves up, then we're going to look at ways we can fix this and make it better. And I've got like 10 or 11 ideas for doing that. So let's start off with what are some of the most common reasons corrective actions fail. Well, first of all, I mentioned if we think the root cause is human error, then we're going to try to fix the human. So if we try to write a corrective action to address a human error, we tend to gravitate towards the recommendation of a relatively weak fix. So for example, imagine we have a problem where people aren't wearing the right work gloves. And we want to fix that. What do we recommend? Well, most people would say, well, you need to make sure gloves are available. Plus, we should remind the employee of the requirement and the need to wear gloves. I call that a compelling why, and yes, it is necessary, but I'm not sure it's going to change the behavior. The reminder probably won't change the behavior. Some might even want to punish the non-glove wearers. Let's set an example for others to learn from. But how effective are these fixes? What's the probability that people will always wear the correct gloves in the future if we execute these corrective actions? And they are corrective actions. Making sure gloves are available is a good one. But it doesn't mean people are aware of them. There's other things in play. We don't address the work system gaps or weaknesses that fail to prevent errors. That, I believe, is the core reason corrective and preventive actions fail. Our Western culture conditions us to blame people, the weather, and equipment. We try to fix those things or give up because we can't. And we don't fix the work systems that are actually causing the problem. We don't see the ever-present connection between human error rates and weak work system design. Weak work system design equates to higher error rates for any human. All too often, we expect micro error rates, micro level error rates, rates below 0.5% or 0.25%. And you can't sustain such low rates without exquisite work system design. You cannot work from memory and consistently only make errors 0.2% of the time. Unless you're superhuman. So that's the key reason, okay? We don't address the work system gaps. We try to fix the person. We don't see the connection between the way our work systems are designed and used and human error. Also, we probably don't know our real error rates, our real error costs, and our true risk levels. Many more errors occur daily on the job than we capture. Also, risk levels are often higher than we expect due to team member skill level and work setting changes, variation from day to day. I have some customers that never work in the same location each day. We would not invest significant money if the problem's not large enough, but do we know how large the problem is? How well does our investigation and analysis capture the problem's true magnitude? How effective are we at risk level estimation? If we underestimate error rates, we probably underestimate risk. And if we underestimate risk, we often underdesign our safeguards. Well, I didn't think it mattered. I didn't think it was that important. Risk level should drive safeguard design and use. But don't underrate risk level because you're underestimating error levels. We fail to evaluate and improve our existing safeguards. And I'm going to talk about some of the core safeguards here in just a few minutes when we get to the improvement side of things. But in general, people use the same safeguards every day to minimize errors. The same procedures, the same training, the same supervision, the same team members, the same policies, the same rules, the same work environment layout, and so on. It doesn't seem to matter if the risk level for a day's work fluctuates or not. In other cases, some work teams only have ineffective safeguards, such as weak supervision, poorly written work instructions, and no formal training to rely on. And so the potential for errors with those folks is even greater. Work system design drives error rate. A key process that also contributes to fixed failure, I mentioned earlier, that's your root cause analysis process. Too many organizations rely on weak fixes that fail. I'm talking about organizations that provide critical services. They provide high-risk operations, things of that nature, and yet they'll still rely on weak fixes, reminders, discipline, retraining. What are your favorite fixes in your company? What's the case? Why does this happen? Often, it's because your root cause analysis approach allows you to blame people and blame equipment and stop there. It doesn't have you ask the questions necessary to truly dig down to the systemic causes of human error and equipment problems. The design of traditional approaches, such as the 5-Y technique or fishbone analysis, allow us to view human error and equipment failures as root causes. You can put human error and equipment failures on your 5-Y tree or on your fishbone diagram. Might be a few branches out, but it could be there. It's not a good thing to do based on experience. I think it sets you up for weak fixes. To me, it's an analysis process error to blame problems on people and equipment. It doesn't mean we don't consider them. It doesn't mean they're not contributing factors, but they are not the cause. We do not place blame on those things in an attempt to fix it. The better option is to use a root cause analysis approach that looks for the systemic reason a person makes mistakes. And there are systemic reasons humans make mistakes. We're creatures of habit. Additionally, most process problems have a path to failure, even though we may fail to hunt for it. In other words, multiple errors and failures across the process or across the value stream build on each other. Some call this a path of causation. An effective root cause analysis process looks at all the errors and failures across the value stream or across the process. that could help prevent a problem or make it less severe. They don't just focus on those closest to the problem. And that was probably the biggest mistake we made as problem solvers back in the day, is we focused on what was going on right around the defect, right around the obvious process problem. We did not go back upstream and try to understand how we got to that place like we should have. Two final reasons, process improvement fixes fail. We often underestimate what it takes to create and sustain human behavior change. Lecturing people for an hour won't make them change. You won't change by listening to this podcast. You'll change by going out and trying some of the things I talk about in this podcast. You can threaten people, you can be nice to people, but the outcome's the same. You're not going to change their behavior in a sustainable way. Preventive actions in the form of work system change are necessary. We have to change how work is done to drive behavior change that lasts. Change how work is done to drive behavior change that lasts. Finally, we fail to make distinctions between corrective or short-term fixes and preventive and longer-term fixes. In some organizations, they don't even pursue or require preventive fixes. They're okay with band-aids. In many cases, the two types of fixes for a given problem are different. I think they're both necessary. One fixes the shorter-term issue. One looks at the larger system problem. That's what I've seen through experience. The preventive action is not necessarily an extension of the corrective action, such as change, do this differently next month, and then keep doing it for the next year. No, it's often a very different fix. Such as replace the part, then quit buying that part, get something better. It's a higher order form of work system improvement. So instead of just retrain, change how we train. Instead of improving how we replace a part each time it breaks, switch to a more reliable part or change the process that we use to replace parts. For all we know, we're contributing to part failure by the way we replace the part. Okay, that's enough griping. Now let's look at how to fix things. Number one, take advantage of the difference between corrective and preventive actions. I did a Wikipedia check on the two terms, and I wasn't really happy with the posted definitions. I didn't want to take the time to debate and try to sort all that out. So I'm going to go with what my peers and mentors and my experience have taught me over the years. I've worked with some very great CAPA managers over the years, and I want to use the definitions and examples that they use to teach me the difference between corrective and preventive actions, because I didn't know about it until I started working with these folks. In short, the two types of fixes are very different, and you need both fix types if you want to sustain micro-level error rates. Corrective actions are like a band-aid. They show that we took action to address a problem's causes. On the other hand, preventive actions go after the source of non-conformity. When we write an effective preventive action, we change how work is done. Instead of improving one instruction set, we improve the process and criteria for instruction set design. And that's a fundamental distinction. The difference between changing the document and changing the process for creating the document. In an effective CAPA system, we write both types of actions to address problems. We follow up on both. Corrective actions address short-term immediate concerns and show that there are no further risks to the downstream customer. They help mitigate immediate risk. Preventive actions focus on longer-term improvements that prevent future errors and failures. However, I find that most organizations fail to teach people how to make clear distinctions between these two types of fixes. Okay, so first of all, make sure folks know the difference between the two. Make sure that you have both. Know the difference, have both. Number two, focus on system gaps for better corrective and preventive action alternatives. When a person uses a work system gap or weakness as their initial corrective action reference point, they're more likely to recommend a systematic fix. Sounds simple. But before you toss my observation aside, look at the collective nature of the last 50 or so fixes you've written. Because I bet you blame some folks. It seems simple, really. If we think a person is to blame, we try to fix the person. It's literally how parents often raise their children. When equipment fails, we repair the car. It looks like we took action. Hey, we did take action. However, how well do our actions prevent or at least extend future errors and failures? Why did the errors and failures occur? If we can find and fix the causes of the errors and failures, our fixes are much more likely to last. How relatively strong or weak are the processes and fixes you propose? Where would they fall on the hierarchy of controls? What percent of the time do you attempt to change people instead of changing how work is done? What percent of your fixes are preventive versus corrective in nature? And how often do your fixes actually change the way the job is done each day? Okay, so focus on system gaps, not people and equipment. Number three, change how work is done to minimize human error. Let's look at that a little more closely because all people make mistakes. And if we want our folks to produce error-free work, we must design work systems that discourage versus encourage human error. Well, I don't need to train you. You're already certified. No, not to your equipment, not to your rules and policies, not to your procedures, not to your protocols, not to your workspaces. Our space programs and nuclear power generation companies get this. For example, they rely heavily on well-designed, easy-to-use checklists to help guide people in daily job performance. That's right. Even people with PhD degrees and genius-level IQs don't rely primarily, if not solely, on memory. Think about how many of your employees, what percentage of your employees work from memory almost all the time. And yet you expect zero errors. Think Neil Armstrong and his use of instructions in hand as an astronaut. He's a genius level IQ PhD person. What percentage of the time do you count on memory to help minimize errors? Dangerous stuff. Is it possible that the use of well-designed checklists has significantly improved performance? I was there myself for years. I saw human error as a root cause until I started teaching Taproot root cause analysis. And then the design of this approach forces the user to look for systemic causes of human error and equipment failure. I go, that makes sense because I'm an industrial engineer. I get human factors. It's just I hadn't linked that into my problem-solving process. So in other words, human error is rarely, if ever, a root cause. You know, it's a contributing factor. Now, we're starting to see that in problem-solving processes. What percentage of your root causes are human errors? Is it possible that a different root cause analysis approach could lead you to better work system focused fixes? Number four, and this is probably, I probably should have put this one up at the top. Most work teams use five core safeguards every day. And I've learned this through my mistake proofing work. They just take them so for granted, they don't realize they're using them. But there's five core safeguards that most work teams use every day. They could be very weak, but they're there to achieve effective work process performance. So, for example, all work teams have some level of supervision and training. Might be super sketch, but it's there. Both approaches may need improvement, but we spend daily time and money to provide them in some form or fashion. Also, the work environment typically contains some type of passive safeguard, such as barricades, to help prevent errors. More day-to-day variation occurs with the other two core safeguards, and that's our work instructions and rules. Some people work from memory every day. Others have detailed in-hand instructions. Who do you think makes more errors? Well, yes, job complexity matters. Work experience matters. But working from memory produces many more errors than most people realize. Also, variation exists in terms of how work team leaders use positive and negative enforcement to ensure people follow the daily rules. Most medium to large organizations have some form of these safeguards in place. Smaller teams may not. They just show up on the job site and do the job that someone tells them to do. High risk of error. In either case, leaders rarely measure safeguard effectiveness. They know what they do to stay safe. They count on outcome measures such as injuries, first aid, near misses to let them know if they're being safe, but they never really ask people, well, what makes more of a difference? Is it the work instructions we give you each day? Is it the quality of your supervision? Is it the quality of your training? Is it the quality of your job preparation? Is it the positive way we enforce the rules and create that positive work culture? You know, what are the things that truly affect your performance? And we will want to know that. We want to understand our folks if we want to keep them safe and we want to help them work error-free. So here's a short list. Those are the four key ones. And I've got a few more best practices here. And you can find this whole list on the Great Systems website. It's just gotten to the point to where people aren't going to take this long to read an article and they'd rather just listen to this. So I'm going to sum up some additional best practices I found to help you write more effective corrective actions. I've mentioned this multiple times in this podcast. Review your most 50 or so root causes and corrective actions. Know your patterns. Know your favorite fixes. What patterns, biases, and gaps do you see? It's like doing your budget for the first time. You never knew you spent that much money eating out, you know? You'll find cases where you don't identify any root causes for certain areas because your problem solvers and investigators aren't looking at those areas. So you need to, are you getting a well-rounded read on what's going on? Or do you have favorite root causes and fixes? Are there certain types of root causes and fixes you don't see often enough on the list? Do some people favor document type root causes versus work environment root causes? Versus people-based root causes. Another one is require the effective completion of a corrective action writing class. At a minimum, take a couple of hours to give people a look at, here's examples of well-written fixes, here's examples of poorly written fixes. Here's example of corrective actions, here's example of preventive actions. You know, they should be able to take a one-page test and classify 10 items on a page as to whether they're a corrective action, a preventive action, whether they're a strong fix, whether they're a weak fix, whether they're detailed enough or not, you know, is it good or bad? That's a very easy way to teach corrective action writing. You can also do peer reviews. You can do the grading thing if you want, but I've seen much more effectiveness with sharing examples of both well-written and poorly written fixes. And then have people do peer checks on practice exercises. Another thing you want to do, and this is getting a little bit higher level, but you always want to look at your fix mix strength. If I wrote 5 corrective actions, that's my mix. What's the relative strength of that mix of 5 fixes against potential problem severity? Not actual problem severity, because you might have gotten super lucky, but potential problem severity. So if we had a near miss fatality, you would expect a mix of fixes that falls higher on the hierarchy of controls. All too often, we base our mix of corrective actions on what happens versus what could happen. The difference between a near miss and a fatality is often not that much. I've seen cases where it's 6 inches. We should not dilute our mix of fixes just because we got lucky. Instead, always ask what could have happened. You can then focus on the future prevention of that problem. Number 8, set a creative engineered fix minimum threshold. In other words, one way to do this is always expect to have at least one engineered fix of some fashion in the mix of changes you recommend. Now, if it's a very minor, low-risk fix, you know, you folks have already eliminated all the serious stuff. You're going after the nonconformances now, and even your critical nonconformances have been minimized. Yeah, you might have a case where you just use weak fixes. Another way to encourage engineered fixes is what we do in the Taproot class. We work our way down the hierarchy of controls as we look for solutions. You know, we're trying to get rid of the potential for the problem in the first place. We'd like to better protect the customer or the patient from potential hazards or errors. If we can't get rid of the errors and hazards themselves, can we do a better job of guarding the customer or employee from the potential problem? Again, don't let our assumptions block us from asking the questions. And I prefer, how can we do a better job? because if you ask the closed-ended, can we, you're not as apt to get a dialogue-inducing question as if you say, how can we do a better job? Or how could we have done a better job? Also, check for evidence of corrective action effectiveness. And the way you do this is you look at your high-risk behavior observation trends. You have to have sensitive leading indicators of what's going on with your work processes. You can't wait for bad things to happen to tell you what's going on, because there's all kinds of other errors occurring that don't bubble up to super bad thing, but they still cost time and money and dissatisfy customers, either internal ones or external ones. The best way to tell how well your fixes work is to capture and trend daily high-risk behaviors at the process level, at the work team level, where work is done. And just have the team ask each day, do we have any key errors today? Was there a decrease in our error and failure rates from what we normally see? How's our trend looking? Also, take this time to talk to the group and try to reduce the holes in your current safeguards before you add new ones. You know, how effective are our work team meetings? Don't add on an extra meeting or an extra form or an extra session when we're already investing time on forms, on meetings, on training, on sessions. We don't even measure the effectiveness of those safeguards, so we don't know if it works. We assume they work, so we need more. But maybe we just need to make the time we're investing pay off better. Opportunity exists for safeguard improvement when you use best practices as a guide. Don't spend more time and money to prevent errors. Instead, spend your current time and money investments for this purpose differently. Smaller holes in the cheese slices wins the game, not more cheese slices. Number 11, always question the potential impact of a potential or corrective fix. Think about, will this really work? Will this really change behavior? Will this increase the likelihood the job is done right the next time? Ask the user. It's even more important to assess the relative impact of the mix than it is an individual fix, because the fixes trade off. But will the mix of fixes significantly reduce the likelihood of future errors or failures of this type? There should be synergy between the changes you propose. Higher quality instructions lead to more effective training, either on screen or on the job. Job prep processes are requisite for excellence, but effective leaders must guide the execution of such prep processes. The work environment should encourage rule compliance, not discourage it. Finally, system-focused root causes lead to better process improvement fixes. If we continue to try to write corrective and preventive actions to address human error or equipment failures directly, we will continue to write relatively weak fixes. It's habitual, it's psychological, it's human nature. That's the psychology of fixes that fail. Additionally, we should expect our preventive actions to address higher level work system gaps and result in more change. The best fix you can personally make is to reject human error and component failures as root causes. Instead, always search for the systemic reasons humans do the things they do, because they don't really intend to do those things. They don't want to do harm. They don't want to get hurt. They don't want to call attention to themselves. They don't want to mess things up for the customer. So ask them, what's going on? Try to understand the error. How often do your fixes fail? Could a root cause analysis process shift, along with a psychological shift, lead you to a more error-free workplace? Check out my webpage, the post that I made on this topic, if you want to learn more about the different things that I've talked about here. I'm doing several live events in the first half of 2023. I'm going to continue to throw at least one podcast out there every week. I'd love to have a chat with you on a podcast. I'd love to talk about a topic that you're interested in on a podcast. You can always drop me an email at Kevin, K-E-V-I-N, at greatsystems.com. There's a lot of cool stuff coming in the next few months from Great Systems. And if you're in the Louisville area, I'm there February 15 through 17. If you're in the Houston, Conroe, Texas area, I'm going to be down there at the end of April. So a lot of cool stuff going on, but I'm always available virtually. So best of luck with your corrective and preventive fixes in the future, and keep improving. I'm Kevin McManus, Chief Excellence Officer of Great Systems. Have a superb day. So long, people.